Our guest today, Alan Gompers, author of Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom. And as I said, the story itself stands out, but given how many discussions we've had about prison-related issues, specifically around rehabilitation and recidivism, Alan's story is particularly appropriate. And Alan, welcome to the Afternoon Edition.
Thank you, Daryl. Sorry about the mix-up. I think I accidentally got cut off on my end. So.
And no worries. We got you now.
Great.
Alan, let's start off with just the basics of your story. I mean, you were a typical middle-class kid, a success story early in your life.
Well, that's true. That word success is loaded because, all adjectives like that, they can have double meanings. And, you know, success can be something that's perceived. Or success, true success for me is something that you experience inside no matter what the perception is on the outside. And for me, you know, I had a lot of that outer perception. You know, I had a lot of things that I attained in my life, money, success, fame, power, you know, a lot of the trappings that so-called American dream is supposed to produce to make happy people. But inside, all through that whole time, except for the moments that I kind of hit the lottery, so to speak, in whatever I was doing, inside I was dying.
Well, if we look at your career, it's almost as if you were reinventing yourself in cycles.
Are you talking about towards the end?
No, you go through music, then you enter into teaching, and then into stock as a stockbroker. It was almost as if you went through these cycles of life where you were consistently trying to reinvent yourself.
Well, that's true. And for me, those, you know, as I came to understand later on in my life, Daryl, was a determined, intense search to find something, someone that would end the loneliness, the depression, and the fear that continually used to rise up inside me, and as I got older, grew more in intensity.
Well, let's talk about a couple of those careers in music early on, in your doo-wop career, with what you'd say a fairly successful musical group at that time.
Well, you know, yeah, it was wonderful. You know, in those days, rock and roll was born. Alan Freed, the disc jockey, created the word rock and roll. And the sound of doo-wop was kids standing on street corners and park benches and hallways and bathrooms anywhere that would amplify the sound and create an echo. And this music began with young kids, 14, 15 years old, the Platters, the Drifters, and whatever. My group, the Montclairs, was a group that got created out of the magic that it was. That was our music for the kids back in the 50s. Doo-wop was the music of the teenager.
And for many people, and especially here when we're talking about Bloomington, Indiana, we have a rich musical community. I mean, that would seem to be, for many kids, young adults, a dream come true.
For me, it was the first, you know, Daryl, for me, that first time I walked through a little hallway late at night, there was five kids huddled in a corner in this hallway because it had like a sound stage. It was like an echo chamber. And they were singing a song called Sunday Kind of Love. It was kind of the first ballad that music ever produced. And it was a huge hit. And when I heard the sound of those voices blending together in five-part harmony, it touched my heart in a way I felt my heart was going to fall literally out of my chest.
But what happened to your that love of music?
Well, it was an invocation. It inspired me to want to go out and form my own group, which I did. And we started making records. We started singing at local rock and roll shows. I sang at a Sweet 16 party, and that was where I met my first wife. And we fell in love, got married, had a little baby. I became a teacher. Went to college and got my license to be a physical education teacher, and life was real good. Until the 60s came along, and the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Motown came in, and rock and roll, as I knew it, the doo-wop sound began to die, and along with it went my marriage. My wife took the little baby. She was only a year and a half old, and it was 20 years later before I ever saw her again. And with it came back all of the those intense feelings that I was talking about, the fear and the loneliness and all that went with it.
Well, and at that point, was it 1970 was when you became stockbroking. You became a stockbroker and an investment banker and experienced the type of financial, and I'm going to use that word again because even though it is an outside perception, I mean, that's what you're measured by initially, and a tremendously rapid, successful career in investment banking, but undergirded by some things that people weren't really seeing.
Well, that's true. You know, I was a teacher. Actually, we started much earlier. We started around my partner, who was my friend, and I got together around the late 60s, around 67, 68, selling mutual funds and breaking records at some of the Oppenheimer and Dreyfus and some of these big financial institutes. And we started to gain a rep and eventually got picked up by a brokerage house and about a year later became partners. And suddenly the skies opened up and money started raining down on us. We became underwriters and investment bankers. And I had more money than I ever dreamed was even in existence. And everything, the thing was, I had invested so much of my hopes, so much of my idea of what it would be and what it would take to finally end these feelings of self-worthlessness and depression, because money was the final answer. It was the last option that I had, and I had it all.
Were you addicted to the rush of the game of investment banking that made you push the limits in crossing the SEC and what ended up closing your banking career?
Well, yeah, a rush is a good word. An addiction is an even better word, because what had happened to us is that it got so crazy that every stock we brought out, every underwriting we brought out, in a time when the market was depressed and in a down, you know, bear market, the major brokerage houses were bringing out $20, $30 million underwritings, and they were opening at a discount. All our stocks were opening up at 200 to 300 times their value. So it was like New Year's Eve every time we did it. And we got to a point where it was so intoxicating, we didn't want it to end. And there was this subtle denial that let us think that we were the chosen people, that what we were doing was benefiting humanity on some level, and yet in reality we were rigging the stocks and falsifying the markets and causing the stocks to rise unnaturally. And of course it wasn't a fair and trading market, so the SEC and the NASD came in and eventually shut us down.
Our guest, Alan Gompers, author of Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom. But Alan, with the SEC and the feds coming in and getting that federal probation, why wasn't that a wake-up call?
Well, it was, as long as it lasted. You know, the thing is, I think this is such an important thing for your listeners, for all of us to understand, how powerful the mind and the ego is in terms of the conditioning it puts on us that causes us to lose sight of what's right and true. I didn't want to look at things. I didn't want to accept things. I wanted only things for myself, and as a result, it caused me to do things to sustain that and continue it.
Well, would you have considered yourself, or do you, at that point in time, a criminal mind? I mean, we hear that word used a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, criminal mind is, again, a label that gets put on. When I was in prison, over the years, I found that when you get back into your heart and when you get back into your humanity and you're taken away from the drugs, whatever they may be, real drugs or money or sex and rock and roll, there's a real beautiful being underneath all of us. And that may sound very idealistic, but I've learned that it's very, very true, that when you get in touch with your heart, when you get in touch with who you really are, you start to let go of all of the stuff that causes you on the outside to do things that go against yourself and people, as a whole.
Well, because you start looking at that next transition, I mean, it just highlights the talented guy that you were and are. I mean, you go back, you find a new niche, you're in real estate, you're opening up a nightclub, you're doing boxing promotion. Why the drugs? Why did the drugs become part of that lifestyle?
Well, I can only answer it one way, and that's this. I went through my life finding success in so many different niches, searching for it, and starting with singing. I'm married, you know, twice to two incredibly beautiful, sensual women who filled my life with all of my sexual fantasies and all of the things that I thought a woman was capable of giving a man, money, recognition, friends, family, all of the things that I went after, I got. And then, at the height of it, the money seemed like the last option. At that point, Darryl, I had no more, I had nowhere else to go, and I was still feeling depressed. I didn't know what else to do. And I had everything I thought that should have ended it, and it didn't.
Did you know when you were selling and you made that sale to an undercover cop, did you have a sense that it was only a matter of time and that might have been the sale that was going to undo it?
No, I to tell you the truth, when I did the drugs, I was actually allergic to drugs. And for me to sell drugs, it was when I left the real estate business, because at that point in my life, I wanted to have something real. I voted for my family and my children. I wanted out of the rat race of money and competition and dog eat dog. I wanted to take a break. And the selling of the drugs was an opportunity for me to continue the lavish lifestyle that I had, and to be with my family and my children. Because in order to do that with the drugs, I didn't have to leave my home. People came up, you know, and they were friends that I was dealing with. It didn't seem so horrible to me because everywhere I went, people were into it, or the people in my circles were. I sold the drugs because it was a way in which I could continue my lifestyle without having to, you know, take responsibility for any other vocation in my life at the time. I wanted a break.
Well, walk us through that, the arrest, and what went through your mind the moment that you realized I'm caught, I'm done.
Well, when I came home one night, I was coming home from the gym. We had just signed with the Madison Square Garden. Gil Clancy set us up with a fight that was to be the last fight before a title shot for my fighter. So it was an exciting time. Things were going my way, and I drive into my driveway, and the police were there waiting for me. And they came out of the woods, surrounded me. I was thrown down on the hood of a police car, Darryl, and a hand grabbed me by the neck and said to me, with a gun pointed in my head, the back of my head, "You are in more trouble than you've ever been in your whole life."
Well, this is a point in time where we're talking about mandatory minimums, a hard prosecution of drug crimes, and you're caught in the middle of it. And what was it, 15 years to life?
Yep. It was an A1 felony of 15 to 25 to life, which was the same sentence you got for murder. It was under the old Rockefeller law that they, if you sold more than an ounce and a half of cocaine, you are automatically, if you're convicted, it's a mandatory life sentence. And I could have gotten 25 to life. The judge gave me 15. And that was what I wound up with, a life bid.
And you ended up going from prison to prison. What, Sing Sing was your first?
Well, actually, the first one was Rikers Island.
You got to Rikers?
Yeah, Rikers Island, and which was the probably one of the most outrageous lockups in the country. It was just a wild, crazy, it felt like Dante's Inferno. I can't tell you how scared and frightened it was. Like it felt like death to me is the best word I can use.
And here you are. You end up being convicted, 15 years to life. That first realization when you're walking among hardened criminals, murderers, rapists, the only thing I can think of is fear.
The ultimate gatekeeper to freedom, which is what my book's all about. That fear was so intense when I first, arrived at Rikers, and they put me in the cell block in this the description in the book, you know, you have to read it because it's surreal. It's not of this world. But at any rate, the fear was so intense that I didn't know if I could make it through the night. And in the middle of the night, the riot squad came up. The doors clanged open. The prison lights came on. People were screaming, and I thought they were coming up the stairs into my cell because I was so paranoid. Instead, they ran to the cell right next to me. A young kid, 20 years old, had executed himself and hung himself with his own belt and died in the cell right next to me that very first night that I was there. And only thing that went through my mind, you talk about fear, the only thing that went through my mind was the word life. 15 to life. Life. I was going to have to live this for the rest of my life.
At what point did you start to develop a survival mechanism and a realization that your day-to-day life was going to be focused around that survival?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understand where you're going with that.
Here you are. You're in prison, life in prison, hardened criminals, and knowing that there is nothing else that you can try to preserve except to preserve your well-being.
Well, I didn't even have that. The first night when they took me upstate to the maximum security facility where I was going to spend, in my mind, the rest of my life, that's the way my mind was working. The 15 part of it didn't even enter into it. And they closed the door behind me, that cell door behind me that night. I remember sinking to my knees and realizing in that moment on the floor that everything in my life was gone. And my money, my wife wound up with another man. After 2 weeks, she panicked. My children seemed like they were from another lifetime. And the only thing that I could touch in that moment, Darryl, were those feelings of loneliness and fear, and they were screaming inside of me with an intensity that was so great that if I could have died on the floor right there, right then, for me, it would have been an act of mercy.
But then you had a moment, a different kind of moment.
Yes.
That has been defining for your life this point forward. And talk about that moment for us.
Well, to get into it, you know, the end of the first chapter of my book, I describe it this way. I have found freedom. I have learned that true freedom flows uninterruptedly deep inside every human being, an internal, eternal river of serenity, independent of all worldly things, available to everyone, all the time, regardless of outer circumstances. And what triggered that for me was when I went out, they pointed me out to the prison yard. There was 2,000 inmates, most of them lifers, most of them with nothing to lose. For the first time in my life, I was in inmate population in this maxi place. And I walked out into the yard, and the fear in that moment was greater than at any other time I can ever remember in my whole life. And the only thing I saw was a running track. I made my way to it. I started to run, and I exploded into a volcano of tears and emotions that just came pouring out of me. I couldn't stop even if I tried. I couldn't. And at the end of this episode, it lasted about 20 minutes as I ran around the track, I just made my way to a corner of the prison yard as far away from everybody as I could get, and that's pretty difficult in that yard. I sat down, looked out. There were mountains rising up over the prison wall, and as I saw them, my eyes flooded, my legs crossed, and for some unknown reason, I found myself dropping into a profound state of meditation. And the thing was, Darryl, I didn't know what meditation was. I had never meditated before. I had no idea what I was doing. But when I opened my eyes again, it was probably about a half an hour later, I looked out and I saw a world that I had never seen before. It seemed like somebody took a magic scrub brush and cleaned the air. It was dancing with light. I could see almost molecules of air that were crystallized. Inmates walking around, the sunlight was dancing off their heads, off the gun towers. It was incredible. And what I came to realize later on is that that perception of the world around me, the immediate environment around me, that I thought was so magical and so surreal, was a world that was always there. I was so locked into fear and depression and so in such a contracted state all my life, I never took time, as you, as one would say, to smell the roses and realize how beautiful, how perfect the world was. And there I was sitting on the ground in a maximum security prison with 15 to life, maybe never getting out ever again, my wife with another man. And I tell you, Daryl, I was feeling happier and more at peace right in that moment than I ever did before in my whole life.
I've heard you say it was an issue of understanding there was nothing to lose.
Well, you're nothing to lose in what sense?
And that at this point, after the that you're going through this meditative process, that moving forward, that this is the future that you have now in front of you.
Well, at that moment, ultimately that is true. But in that moment, when I came out of that, I remember just sighing in kind of like an ecstasy and just looking up at the sky. That's the only place I knew. And saying, if there's a God out there and you can hear my voice, if you would just allow me to hold on to these incredible feelings, I will never, ever again ask for anything else. That's how exquisite those feelings were. But I didn't know how to hold on to them. I was terrified that I was going to lose them, that this was another one of those temporary, you know, hitting the lottery ecstasies or a stock going to the moon and making zillions of dollars that was going to betray me at some point. So when I got back to my cell, I grabbed anything I could to read that might explain what had happened to me, and ultimately one of the guys in my cell block, he was a lifer, it was 36 of us, all lifers, he shows up at my cell and looks in and he says, hey man, check this out. I saw you out in the yard. I know what you were doing. And he hands me a book. It had a picture of this Indian spiritual master, meditation master from India. And I held the book in my hand, and the minute I touched it, my knees buckled. I almost fell flat on my face, and that same experience I had out in the yard just began to waft over me all over again. And I sat down and I began to read this book, and I can tell you I had never, ever read anything like this in my whole life. And it wasn't the words, although they were powerful, but the words and the wisdom that came out of it came with an experience.
Hey, Alan, do we have an opportunity? Can we keep you over for a few minutes?
Sure.
We've got to hit a news break, and we'll come back more with Alan Gompers, author of Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom, right here on WGCL in the Afternoon Edition. Joining us on the phone, we continue our discussion with Alan Gompers, author of Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom. And as I said at the top of the 4 o'clock hour, an incredible story, and that captivated me. But also what pulls you in is, in my interest as well, we've talked about prison-related issues so often here on the Afternoon Edition. You talk about rehabilitation and recidivism. Here's an individual with a story to tell that speaks to these issues. And Alan, I want to pick up where we left off. You're talking about that moment of clarity that
right.
that you had. How far into your sentence at that point were you?
6 months.
6 months.
Yep. I was. I started in March, and this happened like around September of the same year.
And here's the part that is difficult. That here you are 6 months into a sentence that could be a lifetime, but yet you're at peace. What it sounds like, you're at peace with it.
After that meditation experience, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh. What, not only at peace with it is the understatement of the year, because it was the first time in my life ever that I had an experience of happiness and contentment and a sense of freedom, which is really kind of like the X factor in my life, that word is so rich for me now, that lasted uninterruptedly, that never to this day, almost 30 years later, has never left me.
And at that point, what were other inmates, were they saying anything about what they saw? This they saw this guy over in the corner of the yard going into what, not really knowing what you're doing.
Initially, it created a whole lot of stuff. Initially, I was the weird, they used to call me the yogurt man, because they have, for lack of any other understanding, but I was this weird guy sitting out in the snow and the rain and whatever, because I always went back to that same spot to meditate every day, because after reading that Indian meditation master's book, he said meditate in the same space every day. So that's what I did. I wouldn't want to lose it, so I went back out into the prison yard every day. But what happened after a while is that the fear and intimidating qualities of the inmates that used to scare me to death started to disappear, and I started to feel so connected to myself. I had a presence about me that exuded a confidence. Well, not an arrogance, but a confidence that I was just fine. And I started to look at the inmates without any fear. And I realized, and this is crucial for anybody listening, that it is fear that sets us up for a predator. Like a shark is drawn to blood, these inmates are geared around fear because they are, you know, a lot of them are, you know, take advantage of people, and that's what got them in trouble. And they really hone in on somebody who's afraid because you're vulnerable. But when you're not, and it's real, I mean, you can't fake it. That whole macho thing is a fake. It's a cover up for fear. And it always winds up getting people into trouble. But when it's real, when there is a real sense of integrity of who you are and a sense of fearlessness that you exude, nobody ever bothered me again.
What was the difference, though, Alan? Because in the careers that you had as a stockbroker, as a musician going out on the stage, real estate, owning a nightclub, all of those things, even as a drug dealer, there you had to have had a confidence about you. And when you're comparing those two confidences, what was the differentiation that made what was going on in prison with you so different?
Well, what a great... Well, I mean, that's an absolutely fantastic question. And the answer to that is the things that I did... Every time I ever got up on a stage, I was scared to death. Every time I went to buy some drugs, it was exhilarating and also frightening all at once. Singing in front of an audience... Back in the days of the doo-wop, meeting a beautiful girl, whatever, it was always riddled with anxiety, riddled with tension, and riddled with fear, and at the same time, overridden by the thought of what it might bring me. So there was this dichotomy going on always inside of me. But what this other confidence I'm talking about had none of the former and all of the latter, so to speak. It had all of the richness of a really... total, complete feeling of self-worth and confidence with an absence, total absence of anxiety, tension, or fear.
I'm struggling with this question in some ways.
Did that answer it?
Okay. Yeah, it did. But it also, there's also the issue of, I don't know if it's morality or ethics that come along with it as well, that was it the fear that forced you into and the manipulation, the disregard for the rules of the SEC, just the blatant disregard for the drug laws in this country, that fear that now is gone, that also brought you with that morality and ethical grounding that you carry today?
Yeah, well, what I have come to know, and you know, when I do workshops and I speak in front of groups and organizations all over the country, I talk about that a lot. And the real issue with the fear now for me, as I see it, is that was the ultimate benevolent compassion of the universe trying to wake me up to recognize that I wasn't connected to my true self. I wasn't connected to the real truth. true self inside me.
Do you use the word God? And would you consider yourself a religious man?
It's a loaded word, and I do. God is, for me, a definition that I'm very careful about using, because it's like the word love. You mention it, you sit in a room, you know, when I do a workshop, I'm sitting there with 40, 50 people, and I'll ask them, what do you mean when you use the word love? What do you mean when you use the word God? And they all answer it, and everybody's got a different, you know, idea. And, you know, we're talking to each other about these words, but we're not really communicating with each other, because one person's concept is another person's difference. And so how do we really understand each other if you understand that word differently than I do? So what I try to do, without trying to be cute, is to try to talk and use words that are universal, that we can all identify with, without creating a dissonant harmony that's going to say, whoa, I can't go there because I am of such a religion, or I am such a faith or belief system. Because ultimately, this feeling of God, as you use the word, or my understanding of it is that we are all one, and we are all the same at the deepest level of being. And even quantum physicists, even science today at the deepest level, understands that. That there's only one energy that is the substance of all life. There is nothing else going on.
And okay, you're 6 months in, and this is where I think is interesting, is that here you are, you're 6 months into, you've had this discovery, and then what is it, three years later, you're called in to the warden's office, and you're told that you have been one of five out of the entire prison system to have your sentence commuted, and your fear reemerged. You were scared.
Well, not in that moment. That's a little, that's true, but it didn't happen in that sequence. When he told me that I was one of five men and women that was selected for an executive clemency, a pardon, and he handed me the letter, he was waiting for me to jump out of my skin, and he thought that would be the greatest news I could ever get. At that point in time, Darryl, my life was so in balance that it's like, you know, I didn't need anything to bring me up. It's the best way I can put it. I was already there. So when he told me that, I didn't react, although I recognized that I was going to get out, and I didn't know what the terms of the clemency was. But I didn't react in the way he expected me to, like New Year's Eve had happened. And he kind of looked at me and scratched his head why I wasn't reactive. I did appreciate it, and I did thank him. But when I walked out in the hall, I was feeling, you know, the same as when I walked in. But at that moment, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, that's when the fear came up. And I looked at it and I said, well, you know, it had been 2 or 3 years before that I hadn't had any fear in my life at all anymore. The loneliness had disappeared. The meditation had kind of eradicated all of that negativity. And here I was with that fear right back full blown again. And I thought about it for a moment, and I could have been getting out the next day. I didn't have a family to go back to because my wife and I had separated. I had no money. I had no job. I had nowhere to go. But that was not it, because I was more confident and secure in my life than I'd ever been before, and I'd always made it somehow, you know, in the world before. I had every confidence I would be able to do that again. And then it hit me. Darryl, I did not want to go. I was not ready. And it wasn't about the prison, it was about the time. I had been given a sentence, and the sentence was no longer a negative. It was a gift. The time that I had was, you know, I could spend every moment of my life working with this practice that had given me so much, so that when I did finally get back out into the world again, nothing or no one would ever be able to shake that experience from me.
You know, that comment, it's almost as if the prison still was a place of comfort in a way for your own personal development. And I was wondering if, in your work and outreach to inmates today, that is Is jail and prison a place of comfort that is part of the why we see the recidivism that we do, that the individuals are reentered into the world, they don't have those support networks in place, and what they do know is the stability of a life behind bars?
Well, you know, that's another really good observation. For some inmates who have no emotional stability at all and really nothing out in the world, when they get back in the world, they're thrown back into the street, thrown back into poverty. They have no family, or they have a family who doesn't care, or they have nowhere to go or what to do. And so they're right back on the street with the same neighborhood, the same people, the same whole deal, and they wind up coming back. It's obvious. I mean, the fear, you know, creates the need to go out and do something in order to survive, and the only thing they know is how to stick up or shoot drugs. So they wind up back in jail again. That was not true for me. I wasn't concerned about making it in the world at all. Nor was I concerned about being in the prison context that I was in. I didn't care. What I wanted was the time. Where I had no, I didn't have anything, you know, what that sentence gave me, Daryl, for the first time in my life, I was into, you know, going 24 hours a day with the real estate business, with the stock market, with the promotion of the boxing, the restaurant, trying to spin, you know, 10 tops all at one time, always. There was never any time for me, and no time for me to get to know me, to get to know my family, to get to know what this life was all about, to answer the questions that had been plaguing me all my life. I didn't want to go back out into the world and get distracted. I was strong, but I wasn't quite there. And you know, when I got back to my cell and I opened the letter, the executive order, my sentence was reduced from 15 to life to 6 to life. And I had 9 years given back to me. And I looked at it and I said, wow, so I'd done 2.5. I had 3.5 more years to go. I let out a sigh of relief. I would never have said that to anybody. They would have thrown a net over me. But for me, that 3.5 years meant that I had three. It was like when we get really uptight, we take a vacation. We go somewhere where it's quiet, somewhere where there's nothing to do, somewhere where we can be with ourselves and re-energize and rejuvenate ourselves. That's the way I saw it. And as I sat down, I looked out on my book, out of the prison bars, through that window, I could see the mountains. And as I looked out there, I hear this voice inside. Call it God. Call it your inner self. Call it the wisdom. Call it consciousness. Call it intuition, whatever you want to call it, which was my companion after that meditation experience, which was guiding my life. Say to me, in no uncertain terms, Alan, it is not about getting out. It is about getting free. And you are not there yet. You are right where you need to be, because behind these walls, in this moment, you can hear my voice.
Alan, with that, we have to wrap up today, and it has been a pleasure talking with you. And if people want to find your book, Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom, I know they can go to your website, alangompers.com.
Right.
Amazon.com and in bookstores across the United States?
Correct. If they can go anywhere to get it. If they want to, you know, a lot of people who've been reading the book, who've been, you know, recommending to their friends, if they want an autographed copy, they can go to my website and order it through Alan Gompers, G-O-M as in Mary, P as in Peter, E-R-S, .com, and it will come through my foundation in Memphis, Tennessee, and they'll get an autographed version of the book if they order it that way. Otherwise, they can go anywhere. If the store doesn't have it, they'll order it, but most of the stores have it out front now.
Alan, thanks so much.
Daryl, thank you.
333-2665, pound 1370 if you're an AT&T wireless user. It's the afternoon edition on the Sound of Bloomington, WGCL.